Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a few moments, protecting life from the cradle to the grave. Pope Benedict marks the Italian Day for Life. Speaking out against the use of the death penalty, the Pope sends a message to the Third World Congress against capital punishment, which ended in Paris on Sunday. And helping Christians in the Holy Land. What else can Catholics do to support the Church in the land where it all began? Welcome to the programme. In his Angelus address on Sunday, Pope Benedict recalled the Asian tsunami that struck Sri Lanka just over 2 years ago, killing around 35,000 people. The Pope was greeting a number of Sri Lankan government officials who were among the crowds gathered in a sunny St. Peter's Square for his regular recitation of the Angelus prayer.
My special greeting goes to the government officials from Sri Lanka engaged in the reconstruction of areas struck by the tsunami. Today's gospel shows us the great spiritual fruitfulness that accompanies our wholehearted decision to answer to the Lord's call. May you and your families be strengthened in faith and confident hope in God's promises.
In his words before the Angelus, Pope Benedict also marked the Italian Day for Life on Sunday with another appeal for the protection of human life from conception until its natural end. Noting that the family is currently facing a profound crisis, the Pope called for pastoral and political initiatives to support the family, which he called the cradle of human life. My colleague Emma McCarthy has more.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, la vita, che è opera di Dio, non va negata ad alcuno, neppure al più piccolo e indifeso nascituro.
Pope Benedict said everyone, from the defenseless unborn to the gravely disabled, has the right to life, which is a gift of God. He also invited the faithful not to fall into the false trap of legitimizing euthanasia by thinking that life is at the disposal of pity. Many European nations are facing crucial decisions on social and bioethical issues in the coming months. The people of Portugal face a referendum on abortion. Italy's parliament is mulling the regularisation of de facto couples, while in the United Kingdom the government has backed adoptions by same-sex couples. Sunday, February 4th, marks the Day for Life in Italy. In the opening lines of his Angelus address, Pope Benedict XVI gave his full support to the Italian bishop's appeal that men and women of goodwill love and desire life and defend it as a gift of God from its conception to its natural end.
Nella nostra diocesi di Roma inizia oggi la settimana della vita della famiglia.
Pope Benedict also praised the initiatives of his own diocese, the Diocese of Rome, which dedicated a series of workshops and prayer meetings to the theme of the family this week. The family, said the Pope, is the cradle of life and of every vocation. The family based on marriage is the natural environment in which to rear and educate children, thus assuring the stable future for all mankind. But, added Pope Benedict, family life today is undergoing a deep crisis and has to face multiple challenges. So it must be defended and protected, and we must also reevaluate its unrepeatable, unique nature. While this duty falls first and foremost upon the shoulders of the married couples themselves, it is also the duty of the Church and public institutions to take pastoral and political steps to meet the needs of the newlyweds, the elderly and the new generations. The Pope added that for a serene family life, illuminated by faith and fear of God, also favours the flowering of vocations.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, preghiamo.
Pope Benedict concluded that we pray that by renewing our commitment to the institution of the family, our communities become places of hope, where in the midst of all our difficulties, we say yes to love and our desire for life, according to God's will.
And my thanks to Emma McCarthy for that report on Pope Benedict's Angelus address. Pope Benedict returned to the theme of protecting human life in a message sent at the weekend to the Third World Congress Against the Death Penalty, which concluded in Paris on Saturday. In the message, the Pope says the use of capital punishment is not just an attack on life, but also an offence to human dignity. Echoing the words of his predecessor, John Paul II, Pope Benedict says states have other efficient means at their disposal to guarantee security and ensure that criminals do not re-offend without denying them a chance of redemption. Amongst the organisations sponsoring the three-day Congress was the Rome-based Catholic lay community of St. Egidio, which is pushing for a worldwide moratorium on executions and a resolution from the United Nations General Assembly. Spokesman Mario Marazziti tells us more.
The World Coalition Against the Death Penalty that started at the St. Egidio's headquarters 4 years ago is now having a real momentum while in the world many things are changing. Yesterday the European Parliament approved strongly an initiative for calling for a moratorium and a resolution of the United Nations as soon as possible, possibly this session and this year. And this is now part of what we are discussing at the Congress in Paris. And as well, there are important steps that are being taken by South Korea, and there are important changes in Taiwan, so some hopes also in Asia, and this Africa that is making the bigger steps forward. The African Union has decided to work on the possibility of stopping execution in Africa. So the thing is that over the last 15 years, there has been a big change. 40 countries have changed their place, and they are now abolitionists just in 15 years. So the death penalty is weakening all over the world. On the other hand, we have, yes, most Arab countries that use the death penalty, and Saudi Arabia, and most Asian countries, like the small Singapore, but that kills more people per percentage than any other countries in the world. And we have India and Japan still where an execution can take place. And in Japan, 4 executions took place on Christmas Day.
In the United States, meanwhile, the death penalty is under what may be an unprecedented review, mostly involving questions about lethal injection, which is by far the most common method of execution there. Amidst a growing discontent among ordinary American citizens, the U.S. courts last January granted 8 stays of executions in as many days for a variety of reasons. Among those prisoners on death row who won a temporary reprieve was Ronald Chambers, who has spent nearly 31 years on death row after being convicted of murder. That's the longest period of anyone currently awaiting execution in Texas, the state that last year carried out nearly half of the 53 executions in America. But why do many prisoners spend so long on death row before their executions take place? To find out more, Susie Hodges spoke to Dale Resinella, a Catholic lay chaplain ministering to inmates on death row in Florida. He told her more about the Chambers case and how there are many other inmates spending a similar length of time on death row.
In the case of Mr. Chambers, according to the press reports and even the reports of the independent humanitarian organizations, there is not a question of guilt or innocence with respect to the actual crime. The crime is horrendous and horrible, and there is no question as to whether or not Mr. Chambers and his co-defendant were the ones that committed the crime. The issue, however, especially for people of faith and Catholics, is do we lower our behavior and our actions to the level of the criminal in responding to crime? So while we acknowledge that the crime is horrendous and the agony of the families of these two young people is just unfathomable, we do not do anything to restore the victims of the crime by proceeding with another killing where we're the killers. And so, yes, he's been found guilty 3 times. He's been sentenced to death 3 times. The question for us is, should we be killing people at all, even when they've done tremendous wrong? And, of course, our dear Pope John Paul II was extremely clear in Evangelium Vitae at paragraph 10 that no one loses their human dignity, their image of God, even when they've done horrendous evil.
As you say, nobody is disputing the fact that Chambers carried out this murder, but he is one of many inmates who have spent years, maybe decades, on death row. I mean, he's actually spent most of his life on death row. I mean, just how grueling is it to spend so many decades under this, shall we say, this sword of Damocles hanging over you?
Well, first of all, it's important to mention that most Americans are under the impression that these men have spent decades on death row because of their own legal efforts. But as you see here with a man who has had three trials because the state has violated constitutional requirements, his time on death row is due to the actions of the state, not to his own actions. But Mr. Chambers' case is not that unusual. Right here in Florida, where we have now the second largest death row in America, we have five men who have been on death row longer than 30 years. We have six men who have been on our death row for 30 years. And we have six who have been on our death row for 29 years. That's 17 men who have been on Florida's death row for 29 years or longer. So it's not as unusual as many people might think, and it's a very serious concern.
Now, have you met any of these inmates who have been on death row for a long time? What do they say about these long waits, this living on borrowed time?
Well, as you know, the restrictions on my position prohibit me from quoting any of the men that I minister to, but I can tell you that of the men that have been on Florida's death row for 29 years or longer, I know all of them. And if one can imagine going into your bathroom in your apartment and shutting the door and living in your bathroom for 30 years, what impact would that have on your mental condition? What impact would that have on your human spirit? What impact would that have on your ability to function as a human being? A death row cell is 6 feet by 10 feet. With a toilet, a sink, and a cot, it's almost impossible to imagine spending three-fifths of one's life in such a cage. And yet in the case of Mr. Chambers, who came to Texas death row at 20 years old and is now 51, he has spent three-fifths of his life, all of his adult life, locked in a space the size of most of our bathrooms in our apartment or our home. When we make that analogy, we can easily see how detrimental the effect would be on one's psyche and on one's ability to function. There are statements in the press that many men have gone insane because of these conditions.
Susie Hodges talking there to Dale Resinella, a Catholic lay chaplain who ministers to inmates on death row in Florida. The hardships facing Christians in the Holy Land has been a recurring theme of Pope Benedict's over the past few months. Following a special Christmas message to Christians in the Middle East, the Pope returned to the theme on February the 1st during a meeting here in the Vatican with members of the Joint International Commission for Theological Dialogue between Catholics and the Oriental Orthodox Churches, such as the Syrians, Armenians, and Copts. sects. Noting that many of the representatives of these ancient churches had come from the Middle East, the Pope said the difficult situation which individuals and communities face in the region is a cause of deep concern for us all.
Christian minorities find it difficult to survive in the midst of such a volatile geopolitical panorama and are often tempted to emigrate. In these circumstances, Christians of all traditions and communities in the Middle East are called to be courageous and steadfast in the power of the Spirit of Christ.
The need to show solidarity with the struggling Christian communities in the Holy Land is the reason why a delegation of Catholic bishops from Europe and North America in January spent a week visiting Israel and the Palestinian territories, meeting with government officials, local church leaders, and different Christian communities. I travelled with the bishops to Nazareth, Jerusalem, Bethlehem and Gaza to find out more about the difficulties facing Christian families and the way in which Catholics in the West can support their cause. Amongst those taking part in this delegation for the first time was Irish Bishop John Kirby, in charge of the Catholic Aid and Development Agency, TROCERA. He talked to me about what struck him most and what he plans to do to help.
I'd have to say that the wall has been the security wall, security barrier, has been certainly my strongest impression. On the other hand, the acceptance by many of the people and the sense of joy that they have in the midst of a difficult situation. They live in extreme difficulty. They live under many, many restrictions, the wall being simply one of them. There are many others. The need for permit, the difficulties of travelling, the difficulties about movement around in their own country, even on their own side of the security barrier. These have all been encouraging aspects, but I still have to say that the existence of the wall and some of the stories I heard in association with it are my abiding memory.
The people here, the local church in particular, says the West really must help the Christian community to survive here. We must provide moral and material support to the hardest hit people here. As head of TROCERA, what is your impression? What is your reaction to that appeal?
I think that's a very worthwhile appeal, and I will certainly be doing what I can to give voice to it when I return to Ireland. We came particularly to give support to the very small and diminishing Christian community. We are conscious of the role that they have played in the past. They are a source of stability. They are economically reasonably strong. And socially, they act as a catalyst. They can help bring two communities together. And they themselves are conscious of that. But sadly, they are being diminished considerably by immigration, and large numbers have departed this country in the last 25 or 30 years. I will certainly be doing what I can to alert the people of Ireland, the Catholic people of Ireland, to the situation, and we'll be encouraging prayer. We'll be encouraging renewal of pilgrimage for its own sake, but also for the support of the people here, and I hope we will apply a certain amount of pressure as well.
Ireland, of course, has made huge economic strides over the past few decades, from a relatively poor country to one of the wealthier nations. Do people, Catholics in Ireland today, do you think, really care about the plight of the people here in the Holy Land?
I don't think they are sufficiently aware of that plight. I don't even believe I was myself. This has been very much an awakening process for me. And I am certainly aware, I am certainly know that many people in Ireland will only have the superficial aspect that comes from the general news media. I would hope that we would make them more aware and more conscious of both the suffering here and of their potential ability to do something, even something small, about it.
Ireland, of course, is also a nation which has itself emerged from a decades-long political and religious conflict. Do you see any lessons from your own past history that can be of use here in this terrible situation in the Middle East?
Yes. One of the words we learnt over the last 10 years was the word, the phrase, confidence-building processes. Things to give hope and support to the opposite side, that their concerns were being taken into account. And I think that that is... initially, I was inclined to think, to be amused by the phrase, but I have now realised that it had meaning and value in Ireland. And I think it could have similar meaning and value here as well.
In terms of confidence building, what do you mean, and does this apply to the church as well?
Well, first of all, in regard to the state, it would mean taking into account some of the issues, some of the hurt, some of the pain experienced by the local people, people who were born and bred and whose families have lived here all their lives, and who find themselves discriminated against in terms of housing, in terms of subsidies available for their schools and their hospitals, in terms of requirements for travel. Easing of some of these would be what I would call a confidence-building gesture, making it easier for people to travel in the land of their birth. That type of thing. And others, now I'm aware that there are security issues for the Israeli state, but at times you have to be brave and courageous and go for the confidence building rather than the security issue.
During our visit to the Holy Land, we heard from many local church leaders working tirelessly for justice, peace and dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians. Among them is Archbishop Elias Shakur, head of the Melkite or Greek Catholic Church in Galilee, the largest Christian denomination in the Holy Land. Over 20 years ago, he founded a school for children of all different faiths. Yet despite his efforts, he told me the situation remains difficult for Christians in a country where many promises are made but are not always followed through.
I say the land of promises, where we hope one day justice will prevail and people will respect the diversity that is among all the inhabitants of this country, Jews, Palestinian Arabs, Christians, Muslims, Druze, each one would be able to enjoy his full privacy and give his full cooperation to build a common general future for all of us.
But you're saying that conditions here have not got any better over the time since you've been trying to work together with other church leaders on these issues?
Well, some conditions got better. The basic conditions are still the same. I think there is a need for change of hearts and minds and a courage to look at the non-Jew as a brother and not as an other, and to look as the Jew as he also being our brother. We did not reach that goal yet because of the ongoing difficulties, political problems, because of this horrible war against terrorism and the creation of terror unconsciously by those who want to fight terrorism.
You're talking about one of the keys to the problem of fighting this prejudice. One of the keys is working with children in the schools, and you've got a number of ongoing projects there, haven't you?
Not only with children, the key for the solution is education. Education mainly for children, because we form their attitude, we form their vision, we form their mind while they are still in the elementary school, and we continue in the high school. But education should go also for the adults, very especially for young ladies who are to become the mothers. That means the educators in this oriental outfit, not of their own family only, but of their extended family, of their tribe, of their society. A voice of a woman, I think, might be better heard, might better go to the heart than the threats of a man who has power, might, and very often who has so much arrogance and not enough modesty.
How are you working, though, to put this into practice in very concrete ways?
Well, it's first through education, then through preaching, through influencing my clergy to have one voice in different ways, to speak for the Christian values, and not to diminish or to compare our values with Jewish values, saying these are best or these are better. No, there is so many common factors in all the three monotheistic religions. All depends what do we underline, the differences, and they'll become bigger, or the common values, and they become more powerful. And we opted to underline what is common between us all.
And yet there are divisions, though, even among the Christians here in the Holy Land, aren't there serious divisions still? How are you hoping and working to overcome these?
Serious divisions, no. I think among my large community, the largest Christian community, and the Roman Catholic community, the Maronite community, and other Catholic communities, we have no divisions. We have differences, but beyond our personal problems, we manifest one unity, one body, when we are with our Latin brothers, with our Maronite brothers, and we are one body who has different members. And it's normal that we have problems. It's not normal that we be not aware of the problems. But to have problems, it's exciting. We have something to do to improve.
Finally, what is your message here to the leaders of the churches represented here in Europe and the United States?
Well, it's a twofold message. First, let your solidarity be concrete and incarnated in the daily life. Then please go back and tell your people that Palestinians are also Christians. And they need the friendship, the respect of other Christians from Europe and America who come here, and they should not come to visit the shrines, the sand and stones. They should come and encourage the living stones to remain, to stay in the Holy Land.
Archbishop Elias Shakur, head of the Melkite or Greek Catholic Church in Galilee. And earlier you heard Bishop John Kirby, chairman of the Irish aid agency Trocara. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. But be sure to join us at this same time tomorrow, if you can, for another edition of our English programme. Don't forget you can also find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Now stay tuned. Laudato Jesus Christus.